Very glad to see you all this morning. We've got a noisy computer and some very exciting topics to go over today. Let's see. We will start out with a survey of our problem gambling prevention and treatment resources and get an update from the Problem Gambling Task Force. And then we will follow that by an update from the Social Equity in Cannabis Task Force. I just want to start out by saying I really do appreciate the work that everyone who serves on these task forces or participates in any way, really appreciate that work. And it is valuable to us as legislators to hear what your conclusions are as you have dug deep into these particular issues that we care very much about. So just wanted to lay the groundwork that way. Because perhaps some of us are a little rusty now that we've gotten to do a lot of meetings in person. For our virtual committee meeting here, I just wanted to remind folks that we are being recorded and live streamed on TVW and apparently YouTube as well. And just our guidelines pertaining to how the meeting runs. First, you'll need to be recognized by the chair in, before you start speaking. And if a member has a question or wants to provide a comment during the proceedings, you can use your raise hand feature in Zoom, and it is labeled that way down at the bottom of your screen. Then also remember to keep your microphone muted during the meeting so that you avoid any background noise or other audio disturbances. And remember that we are doing active speaker. So if you have an open mic and for instance, your dog supervisor comes into the room to give you a message, then we'll all hear that and you will be on the screen. So in case you want to avoid that, go ahead and just keep it off during your while you're listening. And then we do have a variety of our presenters that are going to be displaying documents. And so do try to have that open and ready to go. When we call on you, turn on your audio and your video and then start sharing your screen. I think I would like to have our committee members hold their questions until after each presenter finishes their presentation. And for instance, in this first section of Problem Gambling Task Force, we have four speakers. So there will be some times in between that we can stop and ask questions. And I do hope you do have questions. So let's see. I know that we do have a couple members who are going to be joining. Oh, actually one member is going to be joining late, but I'm very happy to see Representatives Wiley, Representative Kirby, Representative Chambers, and trying to think, that's everybody on my screen. So thank you very much for coming. And I think we can go ahead and get started. First on our agenda today, we're going to hear from Julia Patterson, who is the chair of the Problem Gambling Task Force. And she is a commissioner on the Gambling Commission. And then her slides, I believe, are going to be presented for us by Victor Coleman, who is the one of the facilitators on that task force and has been doing great facilitation work. So go ahead and let's get going.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, everyone. My name is Julia Patterson, and I have been serving over the last 3 years as the chair of the Problem Gambling Task Force, a task force that you created. And with me today is Victor Coleman of Uncommon Solutions, our contractor, who has been helping us through this process. And he's going to be assisting me on the slides today. So next slide, Vic. See how we're doing here. I wanted to remind you that you created this task force, and here's what you asked us to do. You tasked us, first of all, I'm going to tell you what it is that you tasked us with, what we then did, and then finally, this report will tell you specifically what it is that we are recommending. So here's what you, the state legislature, tasked us with. First of all, you asked us to do a comprehensive review. And as a reminder, the Problem Gambling Task Force was a standalone committee that had staffing and was coordinating with the State Healthcare Authority and also the contractor, Uncommon Solutions. So you tasked us to do a review, and you'll see the bullet points there. That is the review that we did. We looked at the Gambling Commission report. We did a review of all the existing prevention, treatment, and recovery services by public, private, and nonprofit entities in the state. And we also reviewed existing programs in other states and the federal government. You also told our task force that you wanted us to make recommendations to the state legislature. So before I talk about those specific recommendations on the next slide, Vic, I wanted to remind you that the scope of our authority was to make recommendations regarding the state problem gambling program, which is funded by approximately 20% of the gambling net receipts in our state. So of all the gambling net receipts in our state, approximately 20% come to the state of Washington. The other 80% of gambling net receipts are collected by the tribes. So I just wanted to make that very clear that this is about the state program only. However, this task force, and also this task force did not have the authority to make recommendations to you regarding any problem gambling programs or policy associated with the tribes. So as you can see up there, we are making recommendations to you. You asked us to make recommendations about how to proceed with a state prevalence study, and that is your next presentation. If the state should expand state funding, what steps the state should take to improve the current licensing and certification process, and also you asked us to identify additional problem gambling areas for you to consider. The next slide shows you our key data sources, and I won't read those. I'll just let you look those over, but please take note of the fact that the prevalence study is number one on the list. The information that we got from that prevalence study helped us to do a gap analysis to determine what was going unaddressed in the state of Washington. Very valuable information from that study, and Roxanne Waldron will be giving you a full presentation right after I'm through. Next slide shows you our timeline. This project was extended a full year because of the challenges related to COVID. Thank you to the state legislature for granting us that additional year. And over this process, this has been a three-year process. Just to put it into perspective for you, we engaged 28 people in our task force. And those people met and worked as a full task force 74 times during this three-year period. So we completed the review that you tasked us with. We did a thorough analysis of problem gambling services offered in Washington State. For the state problem gambling program, we have a clear picture now of the number of clients that are served and the services each client receives. However, we could not obtain the number of clients served and the services each client received from the 29 tribal nations, and we could not receive that information from private insurers. But in spite of that, we did surface enough information to determine that there are real gaps in service. And this drove many of our recommendations that are here today that you'll soon hear about. We determined that the elements of a robust program should involve those bullet points you see, prevention and outreach, treatment, recovery support services, in other words, aftercare, workforce development, and program monitoring, evaluation, and research. Next slide. With that, we were able to determine how we measure up. And I'll let you take a moment to look at this slide, but Please note, again, that these findings relate to the work of the state problem gambling program only. Our state program is doing the very best that they can with the resources that they have, but we determined that there are very clear gaps. And the prevalence study indicates that we are underfunding the treatment needed by our citizens by approximately 50%. We also took a look at what the federal government was doing, and currently the federal government does not provide any funding for problem gambling services. They don't provide funding through public health benefit programs like Medicaid and Medicare, and they do not provide funding to the states. So the states are really on their own with regard to this social problem. And there have been a lot of efforts currently to engage the federal government in this work, but clearly the burden continues to be on individual states to find funding and support. So before I jump right straight into recommendations, I want to remind you of work that has been underway and also the efforts that have been completed. In other words, it's not like we've been sitting here doing nothing, waiting for this report. The state legislature and the gambling commission have been busy. And here are some things that we have done. We've required responsible gaming training for all commercial venue staff. We ensured that the Healthy Youth Survey permanently includes a two-part question about gambling and problem gambling. The state legislature, established a statewide voluntary self-exclusion program for commercial venues, the card rooms, and the lottery. Thank you, Rep. Kloba, for your efforts there. And through this process, the Problem Gambling Task Force has gained clarity. We've learned about the treatment and recovery services offered by tribal behavioral health programs in Washington State. But there is still a great more to learn here. So here's the work that is in progress. We haven't finished it yet, but I'm happy to say this work is in progress. We are increasing the number of certified gambling counselors in our underserved areas. We are working to increase the reimbursement rates for state contracted problem gambling agencies. We are working to cover problem gambling treatment under Medicaid for individuals who are enrolled in Apple Health. And we are in the process of evaluating helpline practices to determine if we need to make improvements there. So now let's get right straight into what we are recommending. This is the meat of the report. And I want to make note of the fact that these recommendations received unanimous support from all task force members. There are key recommendations in three areas that I'll talk about. The first area has to do with services. The second area has to do with funding and infrastructure. And the third has to do with collaboration and partnerships. So our recommendations, first of all, under the area of comprehensive state-funded problem gambling services, there are six critical recommendations in this area. All of these share a common theme, and that theme is to place problem gambling into the mainstream of behavioral health work in our state. So I know that it's frustrating when presenters read the words that are obviously right there in front of you, but these are important enough that I'd like to do that, Madam Chair. Improve the availability and access to all levels of treatment and recovery support services for problem gambling. Integrate problem gambling awareness, prevention, education, outreach, treatment, and recovery support services integrated into behavioral health and substance use disorder programs. Integrate problem gambling information into clinical behavioral health curriculum, training, and counseling programs. Enhance consumer protections and responsible gaming for vendors, operators, and the public, including youth. And The next one I think is quite important for policymakers, for the state legislature, and that is seriously begin to recognize the impacts of internet use and gaming disorders on youth and adults. This is especially important, in my opinion, Madam Chair, because you, the legislature, are being continuously pushed to expand online gambling. And this push is happening nationwide. And as a reminder, online gambling is illegal in the state, but you're going to be approached. And there are serious impacts on problem with regard to problem gambling and online gambling. And then finally, assess the potential of including problem gambling treatment diversion program within our court system. Those are our recommendations in the area of services. Next slide are recommendations in the areas of funding and infrastructure. So first, funding. A very direct recommendation to the state is to double state funding for state problem gambling, for your state problem gambling program. And this would make it possible for you to double the clients that are served. And that would mean that you could serve approximately 700 people annually. That would make it possible to expand prevention and outreach, to grow the clinical workforce by 25%, and to expand services that are needed because of the fact that gambling has been expanded. And I'm primarily talking about sports wagering. Next is a brief discussion about infrastructure. And what we mean by that word is that we need to implement a new data system for our state program. The current system is no longer supported by the vendor, and it only minimally is supported by the healthcare authority's IT department. It is not adaptable to the needs of the state, and a new system with a modern data system would make it possible for staff to monitor the quality of life measure for all clients served and whether clients are seeing improvements over time. So we think that it's very important that we have that improvement to our data system. The next area, recommendations, has to do with collaboration and partnerships. And so let me say that with the sunsetting of this legislative task force that you created, there will no longer be an organized space for future conversations. This recommendation calls for the state to continue dialogue with the tribal governments with hopes for agreements that will result in comprehensive services for all residents. So to wrap this up, Madam Chair, the bottom line is that problem gambling, and again, I'll read this, is a behavioral health issue that currently stands outside mainstream behavioral health services. It is way past time to remedy that situation and offer our residents a complete suite of services, especially now where access and availability of gambling is becoming so prominent. And considering the pressure to expand is very real and is going to be coming to you. That's the extent of my summary presentation to you, Madam Chair. And at this time, I'm very open for questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Chair Patterson. I believe that the so this was a summary, but we have available the entire problem gambling prevalence study. Is that online? I know I've read it and I'm trying to remember. Was that on the healthcare authority website?
So, Rep. Palba, your next presentation will be from Roxanne Waldron, the program manager for your state program. And you're going to have all those answers in just a second.
See, I'm just chomping at the bit. Do I see any, and your presentation flowed naturally into that, so I appreciate it. Do I have any questions from our legislators. I don't see any. Good morning, Rep. Robertson. Glad to see you here. I hadn't seen you at the beginning. Okay. Oh, I see that Rep. Sorry, not Rep. Commissioner Patterson. Did you have one more thing you wanted to add?
Point of personal privilege.
Yes, ma'am.
Those are words left over from my legislative days. Madam Chair, you know that many of our local governments require an equity lens now to be applied to any policy or laws that are adopted. And this is an idea of mine to share with you. I wonder if state legislators might consider the idea in the future that any gambling policy that is being considered by the legislature or by the Gambling Commission for that matter, that an analysis should be done by legislative staff to determine if and how it might impact problem gambling, so that we have an idea whether or not that policy is fanning the fire with regard to this social problem. So some believe that a policy analysis should be hardwired into policies in the future. So that's my comment. I'm not representing the committee with that comment, but I just wanted to end with that.
Okay, well, I think that is a great place to end. I happen to agree with that. And it is something that we are trying to do overall here at the legislature, but always something that we need to remind ourselves to continue to have a focus on. So thank you so much. I really appreciate you joining us today. We will move on next to, we have Roxanne Waldron, who is the Problem Gambling Program Manager at the Division of Behavioral Health and Recovery at the Healthcare Authority. And so I know you have a meaty presentation for us today about, we're hoping to be about 30 minutes, and I think we're kind of running right on time. So if you want to go ahead and begin, Roxanne, we're excited to hear what you're reporting.
Thanks so much. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Roxanne Waldron, and I'm the State Problem Gambling Program Manager, as you mentioned, within the Division of Behavioral Health and Recovery at the Healthcare Authority. So thank you for the opportunity to present to you today. I'll give a brief overview of the State Problem Gambling Program, and then I will share some highlights from the 2021 Washington State Adult Problem Gambling Prevalence Study. That's a mouthful. We've also provided you with two fact sheets from that should be in your packets that have a bit more detail about both the state program and the prevalence study. So since fall of 2019, the state program has been fully engaged in two problem gambling related projects initiated by you through legislative provisos. The first has been this coordination and staffing for the Joint Legislative Problem Gambling Task Force, which Commissioner Patterson just described. The other project has been the 2021 prevalence study. The final report for the prevalence study was delivered to the legislature in October, and I'll present some highlights in a couple of minutes. So the State Problem Gambling Program was launched in 2005 as a low barrier program that provides problem gambling treatment coverage. A client is eligible for treatment services if they have no insurance for problem gambling treatment and also have had a clinical assessment that has determined that they could benefit from treatment. And Medicaid eligibility is not a factor. So typically during a non-pandemic year, the state program provides treatment reimbursement for between 300 and 400 clients with an average of 350 at an individual cost of about $1,500 per client, which is covered by the program. So the Healthcare Authority currently has contracts with 11 state certified problem gambling treatment providers. About 70% of our program funding is dispersed through the treatment reimbursement contracts. And the remaining 30% is split between a contract with the Evergreen Council on Problem Gambling for clinical training, scholarships, and Problem Gambling Awareness Month, and the state's problem, state programs admin costs, which include one FTE, which is my position. So in the current biennium, the appropriation from the state problem gambling account to the program is $1.461 million. So I just want to point out, if you do look at the budget, that won't match because this does not include two one-time appropriations. One is for the $500,000 for the prevalence study, and the other is for the $150,000, which is to close an anticipated treatment funding gap this budget cycle. But the overall amount that we've had more or less for the last 10 years has been $1.461 million per biennium, or there, or within a few thousand dollars of that. The funding comes from a combination of contributions by the lottery and the business and occupation tax on commercial and nonprofit gambling of 0.13% net revenues above $50,000 per year. I know that's a lot of information, and most of that is in the fact sheet that you have. So since the program doesn't provide direct services, we learned about the need for more treatment funding when our contracted providers ask for increases to their contract funding levels so that they can provide more treatment. So a funding gap happens when the state program doesn't have enough funding to meet these requests for additional treatment funds. So the healthcare authority is also seeking to include problem gambling coverage under Medicaid, which if enacted would allow Apple Health enrollees to access problem gambling treatment. And over the past few years, what we've seen is that 20 to 25% of our clients that we've served through our program are also enrolled in Medicaid. So if approved by the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, Apple Health clients will have access to problem gambling treatment. And this will also allow the state program to stretch our existing treatment dollars to serve more clients who are not Medicaid eligible. So as I mentioned, the legislature appropriated $500,000 for a new adult problem gambling prevalence study. The last study had been done in 1998. And as you know, the gambling environment has changed significantly in Washington state since then. Originally, the prevalence study was scheduled to launch in 2020, but due to the impacts of COVID, as Commissioner Patterson mentioned, the legislature approved the delay of the study by 1 year. So in July of 2021, the Social and Economic Sciences Research Center at WSU conducted the survey, which then closed in early September 2021. So it's open for about 3 months. The survey was available both in a web-based format and paper version, and it was also offered in both English and Spanish. So here are the topic areas on the slide, which I won't read to you, from the legislative proviso, but I will cover each briefly in the following slides. The last topic, topic six, was added by the Problem Gambling Task Force members because this topic hasn't been included before and possibly has implications for problem gambling services. So about 49,000 households were surveyed and over 9,400 responses were received, which was about a 90% response rate, which was right in that area, that range that we wanted, between 18 and 20%. So we're very happy with those results. So as I share these findings, I just want to ask you to keep a couple of points in mind. For the study, when I say participated in gambling or adults who gambled, this means people who engaged in the entire spectrum from purchasing one lottery ticket in the past 12 months to gambling in a casino 5 days a week. This is a measure of participation, not intensity. We did collect information on intensity, but we haven't had an opportunity to deeply analyze that information yet. So I'll also be using the term adults who gambled rather than gamblers whenever possible. To access the full report, Madam Chair and members, there is a link on the last slide of this presentation. It also can be found on the HCA's website under About HCA and then Data Reports and then Behavioral Health Reports. So the report itself contains tables and confidence intervals for individual findings. And lastly, the data analysis can only detect correlation, which means a link between items, but not causation. So we can't say why something happened or what caused what. It's not that kind of a survey. Okay, next slide. So the survey asked all respondents, which means everyone who took the survey, about two opinion questions about gambling that are frequently asked on these types of prevalence studies. So the first one was, which best describes your opinion about gambling opportunities in Washington state? possible responses were, it's too widely available, it's not available enough, or the current availability is fine. So you'll see that there are two pie charts. The one on the left is for all respondents, which is all adults in the survey. And the one on the right is for just those adults who reported that they had gambled. So what's interesting to note that is that among all adults, about two-thirds said that the current availability of gambling is fine. 31% said gambling is too widely available, and about 5% said that gambling is not available enough. However, among adults who gambled, on the right-hand side, a higher percentage said that the current availability was fine. 21%, which is less than all adults, said that the gambling is too widely available, and 8%, which is a little bit more, said gambling is not available enough. So the takeaway from this that we see is adults who gambled were more likely to say that gambling is not available enough. So the second opinion question was, which best describes your belief about the benefit or harm that gambling has for society? Again, we have those two comparison graphs. Responses included that the harms outweigh the benefits outweigh the harms, or the benefits and the harms are about the same. Comparing the two charts, we see that among adults who gambled, a higher percentage said that benefits outweigh the harms. And fewer said that the harms outweigh the benefits, while a higher percentage said the benefits and harms are about equal. So what we see here is that adults who gambled were more likely to see the benefits as outweighing or being about equal to the harms, and a lower percentage said that the harms outweigh the benefits when compared with responses from all adults. So this bar graph shows the types of gambling activities that people are doing and the reported popularity of each activity. This is based only, obviously, on adults who gambled. And also note that people could select multiple activities, so this isn't going to add up to 100%. So about three quarters had reported purchasing lottery tickets or lottery products, and the next most popular choice was tribal casinos, followed by the category of other, which I'll touch on in a moment, and then pull tabs, bingo, raffles, online gambling, commercial card rooms, and finally with a very small percentage of horse racing. That other category was selected much more than we expected. We did have a write-in field, so when resources and time permit, we will categorize those responses. So also in analyzing the survey results, we did see that there were some statistically significant differences in the demographics of people who engaged in different types of gambling activities, such as folks who frequently went to card rooms versus tribal casinos or lottery and so forth. But although this is interesting, that data isn't included here due to limited time. It is described in detail within the prevalent study report, which also includes the frequency tables and confidence intervals for those that are interested. So next, we're going to look at the prevalence of both gambling and problem gambling among Washington state adults. So this colorful pie chart shows both the rate of gambling and the risk for problem gambling among all adults. This chart includes, again, all adults, all respondents. So for the study, if a person reported any type of gambling in the past 12 months, then they completed a problem gambling risk assessment section consisting of 9 specific questions within the survey. The 9-question assessment is called the Problem Gambling Severity Index, and the abbreviation for that is PGSI. So adults who gambled were categorized as having either no risk, low risk, or moderate to severe risk for problem gambling or gambling disorder. So the PGSI is a validated clinical assessment tool that has been used for years nationally and internationally. So on the right side, we see that dark blue section. That is the 56.5% that did not gamble in the past 12 months. That would have been the period from summer 2020 to summer 2021 during COVID. The left side, which is the green, yellow, and red sections, is the 43.5% that did gamble in the past 12 months. So based on past Washington state prevalence studies and studies in other states, this percentage of people that gambled is significantly smaller, like only about two-thirds of what we would expect in a non-COVID year period. This may be due to gambling venue closures and concerns about COVID exposure. But normally, we would expect to see between 60 and 70% of adults that would gamble in a given year. So the light green section is the people who gambled but were not at risk of problem gambling. The yellow is people who gambled and are a low risk for problem gambling. And the red is the 1.5% of all adults who gambled and are at moderate to severe risk for problem gambling, gambling disorder. And that was probably the number one thing we were trying to determine with this study. So that 1.5 percentage, interestingly, is the same percentage that Oregon found in its study that it conducted in 2021 that was looking at how COVID had impacted gambling and other social behaviors in their state. So next, we're just going to look at the left-hand side of that pie chart and look just at adults who gambled. So on this slide, we are looking, again, as I said, just at adults who gambled. And with the previous slide, this pie chart's also broken out by those risk levels. The percentages appear larger because we've taken out all the adults who didn't gamble. So based on the responses to the 9 questions in that PGSI section, individuals received an overall score with a range from 0 to 27. And based on their score, range, they were determined to be at no risk, low risk, or moderate to severe risk. So next, we asked respondents which problem gambling resources they were aware of. So about 60% of the people that took the survey actually even answered this question. So this graph is just showing those that answered the question. The blue bars are the percentage of all adults who answered the question. The green bars are the percentage of those, just those who had gambled who answered the question. And we found that Gamblers Anonymous had the biggest name recognition, followed by the Problem Gambling Helpline. Public awareness of problem gambling resources available through community behavioral health programs, the state program, and tribal behavioral programs, behavioral health programs was about the same. And GameAnon, which is similar to Al-Anon, and the Evergreen Council had the lowest name recognition, despite that the council funds the problem gambling helpline. So on average, adults who gambled actually had a higher awareness overall of problem gambling resources than adults in general. However, Washington State adults as a on the whole aren't very aware of what resources are available to them, whether they gamble or not. So this points to that all problem gambling resource organizations, including the state program, likely need to evaluate how we are communicating information about the resources we offer to the public at large. So for the first time in Washington State, in a Washington State adult prevalence study, respondents were asked if they had gambled online. And please note again, as mentioned, all online gambling is illegal in Washington State. So on the left-hand pie chart, you will see that this is among all adults, that 5% said they had gambled online in the previous 12 months. And then the right-hand pie chart is looking just at those adults who had gambled. And among adults who gambled, 12% said they had gambled online. This is the same group of adults. It's just that we're looking just at those who gambled online, who gambled. So the data analysis shows that almost all of those who gambled online also gambled in brick-and-mortar facilities, including the lottery, because there are no online lottery sales in Washington State, so we've lumped them in here. And people who reported that they had gambled online, these are the folks that recognized that their activity was online gambling. So over the past decade, we've seen what's called the gamblification of gaming. Gambling can frequently be accessed within all types of online games, including social networking games, mobile app games, and so forth. So due to this overlap, the prevalence of online gambling may actually be underreported in the survey. So another important finding is that among those people who gambled online, 10.3% were at moderate to severe risk for problem gambling or gambling disorder, as compared to 3.5% for adults who gambled overall. So it's almost 3 times the risk. So here's what we learned about who is at a moderate to severe risk for problem gambling. As I mentioned, adults who gambled online. And then we also found that adults who gambled using 4 or more types of gambling activities were at significantly more risk, like about 4 times more risk than those who maybe were using only 1 or 2 methods to gamble. So next, we analyzed the risk for problem gambling based reported demographics. And demographics will be like, you know, gender, age, et cetera. We found that with one important exception, there were no statistically significant differences for risk based on most of the demographic categories collected in the survey. And here's a list of those that were not affected by, that did not affect whether people were more likely to develop or be at risk for problem gambling. The one important exception is that despite that we found no differences in gambling participation, that is, people gambled at the same rate, whether they were white or identified as non-white or Black, Indigenous, or people of color, BIPOC, we did find, so they were gambling at the same rate, but we did find that Black, Indigenous, and people of color who gambled were more likely to be at low risk as compared to no risk for problem gambling when compared to white respondents who gambled. So this means that there is a slight increased risk that we were able to see statistically. Additionally, the data also showed that non-white or BIPOC folks, adults who gambled, are more likely to also be at a moderate to severe risk for problem gambling than white respondents. However, this finding should be observed with caution because it was right on the edge of statistical significance. So a larger survey potentially could make that clear whether they are also at risk, at a higher risk for moderate to severe problem gambling. So this finding is supported by other studies and reflects known disparities in social and economic determinants of health, such as increased poverty, lack of opportunity, and access to resources, and worse health outcomes. So with this has clear health equity implications for access to treatment. We did look at correlations between the risk for problem gambling and reported substance use or mental health concerns. We did not have space on the survey to have additional screening tools for substance use disorder or mental health issues due to the size of the survey. We already had 66 questions. So therefore, we can't call these co-occurring disorders because only the gambling risk level has been assessed using a validated tool. So I'm reporting these here as correlations or overlaps. But this is highly supported in many, many other studies. Adults who gambled were more likely to be at a moderate to severe risk for problem gambling when they reported tobacco or hallucinogen use, an alcohol or drug problem, or depression, anxiety, or other mental health or behavioral health concern. So, and then adults who gambled were more likely to be at a low risk compared to no risk for problem gambling when they reported cannabis use. So many other studies have found a correlation between alcohol use and problem gambling, but surprisingly, we did not find a statistically significant difference in the risk level for adults who gambled and had used alcohol in the past 30 days or 12 months. Those are two different questions. So there are two possibilities: that the finding is accurate and there is no direct correlation, or that there is a correlation, but the survey couldn't detect it due to the small size of the problem gambling subgroups. And as I mentioned, a larger survey might uncover a correlation. So in addition to specifically asking if respondents participated in online gambling, the task force also decided to collect data about the percentages of people who were participating in specific online gaming and online gambling activities. And within that, the percentage of people who reported activities that fall into that gray area where gambling and gaming converge. So in a separate section of the survey toward the end, all respondents were asked questions about their participation in these activities. And this included both adults who had reported gambling earlier in the survey and those who did not. So on the slide, you can see the types of online activities that were asked about in the survey. The items that are in red are clearly gambling. Other items are open to interpretation as to whether they are gambling or not. Many do have the three main elements of gambling, which are they have a prize, they have an element of chance to the outcome, and they have a consideration, which is what the person is wagering or expending, such as money, virtual or real items, or even time and energy. So unfortunately, due to time and funding constraints, an in-depth analysis on this section of the data hasn't been completed. So this will be a future project if and when resources are available. We feel that this information may be useful for future discussions about online activities, regulation, and consumer protections against the mechanisms of addiction. So as we wrap up, I just want to share with you that as the State Problem Gambling Program Manager, my goal is that individuals and their families affected by problem gambling are able to access problem gambling services. So this includes not only state-funded services, but also in partnership with others who provide a range of problem gambling services. For example, some tribal behavioral health agencies offer problem gambling treatment, and almost all of them serve both tribal and non-tribal community members. And for inpatient and residential treatment for gambling disorder, which a state does not offer, the Evergreen Council on Problem Gambling funds out-of-state treatment based on funds available. The state program also connects regularly with the Gambling Commission, the Lottery Commission, the Washington Indian Gaming Association, and other partners. So as we've seen within the Problem Gambling Task Force work that we've done, when we work together, we can accomplish much more than any one program or organization can achieve on its own. So thank you for the opportunity to share this information with you today. Here's the contact information for our Legislative Affairs Office contacts, as well as the link to the 2021 Adult Problem Gambling Prevalence Study Final Report. I realize that is in a link, and so I can also send out the specific link to you, Madam Chair, if you would like to share that with your members. So I can take questions if there's time. I realize that was somewhat long.
Actually, your timing is very good. You're right on it, and that is not an easy thing to do with about the amount of information you had to share with us. Definitely, yes, please send me the link, but also I know I hope we have some folks watching either live or will eventually watch the recorded version. And so I think I was asking this of Chair Patterson before, but the Healthcare Authority site has give me a couple of clues of where I would find that.
Absolutely. And I'm happy to do that. So you can find the report on the www.hca.wa.gov. And then when you get to the Healthcare Authority webpage, you would click on the tab that says About HCA. Mm-hmm. Once you're there, you can click on Data and Reports, and then select Behavioral Health and Recovery. And there you'll find both the data report for the prevalence study, which was uploaded quite some time ago, and the final report for the prevalence study, which was uploaded last month.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate that. It certainly is a lot of great information with some interesting implications. So I see that my committee members have some curiosity. Go ahead, Rep. Wiley, with your question, comment.
Thank you, Chair Kloba. I have two areas that I'm curious whether the work or the study or maybe other studies that you're aware of have touched on. Cyber investments that are portrayed as sure things rather than gambling have grown in recent years. Could you make some comments about the perception and reality and the growth of that as you believe it to be? I know there's probably not a lot of data. And is there good data on the economic impact and social impact on both families and the economy at large for problem gambling?
Yeah, thank you so much, Rep. Wiley, for both those really important questions. I'll take the second one first because I know a little bit more about that. There is data on economic impact. Brianna Dora Showal is a national expert on this, and she has constructed a cost-benefit analysis template that we could use in Washington State to look at that. I know that that's of great interest. That was of great interest both to the Problem Gambling Task Force and others. We don't have funding currently within the program to conduct that kind of analysis, but it would be really important, I think, to do that within Washington State. And then we do know, though, that overall within prevention, you know, $1 spent can save, you know, a minimum of $10 down the line. Early intervention can also help reduce severity from gambling, so it doesn't develop into a gambling disorder. So those are already known considerations within prevention and early intervention. So did I sort of answer that question, that specific question for you?
I'm very interested in the not just gambling with cyber currency, mm-hmm. but the cyber and digital investment.
Right.
Digital currency investment.
Okay, so we did actually include several questions on our survey around traded or gambled with cryptocurrency. And we found that actually the rates were pretty low among the respondents that we had. We only had answered the survey, maybe less than 2% had participated in that activity. But we do now have either trading and or gambling with cryptocurrency. We do now, though, have that as a baseline. So when we continue and have another prevalent study survey, hopefully in 3 to 5 years, we'll be able to judge if that is a growing piece. So was there another piece of that cyber piece that you wanted me to respond to, or does that answer that question?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. And that is a very interesting point of inquiry. It's interesting to know, I think it was Kansas has approved gambling with cyber currency. Cryptocurrency. So that's kind of a double gamble, which is interesting to perhaps keep an eye on the implications of that. Okay, let's see. I am not seeing any other questions from the members, but I know they can reach out to you if they have any questions any that occur to them later. Okay, so we are going to move on to...
Thank you.
Our next guest joining us is Rebecca George, who's the Executive Director of the Washington Indian Gaming Association. And we've got you for about 15 minutes. So
Ahead
and let it, we're listening.
Okay, let me first figure out how to share my screen. So give me a second.
No problem. And we are seeing your screen share. Perfect.
Okay.
Nice job.
Got it. Okay. Good morning, Rep. Kloba and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca George, and I am indeed the executive director of the Washington Indian Gaming Association. I am honored to be here to share with you some of the great work happening throughout Indian country. So WIGA, for those of you who don't know, we are a nonprofit association that is comprised of tribal governments here in Washington State. And interesting, as I was preparing for this presentation, a recent conversation that I had with a tribal elder came to mind, who shared with me that we don't have a word in our tribal language for addiction. So addiction is something that has swept through our communities post-contact, and something that tribal governments are working hard to combat. So while I would love to be able to give you a full background on Indian gaming in 4 bullet points, those who know Indian gaming know that it's much more extensive than that. So I have given just a few areas to help frame the discussion as we move through this. Oh, excuse me, I'm looking at a different slide. Responsible gaming. Okay, let me back up a little bit. So responsible gaming has been an integrated part into the foundation of all of our gaming enterprise operations. Washington tribes are investing millions of dollars each year in education, prevention, and wellness programs that support responsible gaming. Tribes provide an integrated approach to treat the whole person and their families. So now I will talk to you about the, the background on Indian gaming and give you some highlights that pertain to the conversation we're having here today. Well, excuse me. Well, your screen says Cabazon v. California. It's actually California v. Cabazon. That was a landmark ruling in 1987 that recognized the tribe's inherent authority to offer gaming. Quickly following that, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was passed by Congress as quite possibly the fastest piece of Indian legislation to ever move through Congress. And the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act establishes the jurisdictional framework that presently governs Indian gaming. Here in Washington, the legislature has authorized gambling for the state lottery, for the tribal lottery, for charitable and nonprofit gaming, as well as a commercial stimulant to food and beverage establishments. Indian gaming is government gaming, where just like the state lottery, the money goes to support essential government services. The video machines operated by tribal enterprises here in Washington is actually an electronic version of our own state's scratch ticket. The proceeds from all tribal enterprises fund important government programs. Four more bullets to describe an entire government. I'll give you some, excuse me, some highlights here. Tribal, there are 29 federally recognized tribes here in Washington state. And like all governments, tribal governments work to improve people's lives, Indian and non-Indian alike, in communities across the state. Each tribal nation is different, where some reservations have just a few acres and others have more than a million. Some have a few hundred citizens while others have thousands. Some of the governments have significant financial resources to finance government services. Others have very limited funds. An important note here is that all casino operations are governed by a separate enterprise board, except for our tribal gaming agents. And that is our TGA work for and report to the tribal government. TGA, tribal gaming agents, are agents that are on site that oversee the casino operations, that it's conducted in accordance with state, federal, and tribal laws. The TGA are the primary regulator and work hand in hand with the TGU, which is the state's equivalent to our TGA through the tribal gaming unit under the Gambling Commission. The gaming commissioners oversee the TGA and they're appointed by the tribal council. At the state level, these appointed commissioners oversee the Gambling Commission, and it's a similar structure here in Indian country. I think this is helpful to know when we talk in a minute about self-exclusion. Tribal governments and tribal casinos work in partnership to promote responsible gaming and to address the needs of those seeking help. Both are working on multiple fronts to prevent and address problem gambling. Through our behavioral health services, tribal governments offer an integrated approach to problem gambling and recovery services. We screen tens of thousands of patients in our health clinics every year, as well as those going through our court systems. We employ counselors and provide resources for those in need. Tribes also offer direct care, including residential and outpatient treatment. We provide recovery services and implement holistic programs with great success to both the addict and their family. We also know that prevention is key. We work with youth and elders, our employees, our community members to promote healthy lifestyles. Indian Country treats the whole person and finds healing in dancing, singing, and reconnecting to community. I have a number of examples of tribal programs, but will let you know that tribal programs are offered free to those who are seeking counseling services and span the state from USC to Southwest Washington to Bellingham. These services are available through our programs.
And those are available to tribal and non-tribal members alike. Is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Switching gears to the services that are happening at the casino is a self-exclusion program. We run extensive self-exclusion programs that help the patron once they have signed up for it. Programs can last anywhere from a year to a lifetime. Most tribes require appearing before our Tribal Gaming Commission for access to the property to be reinstated. Other programs that are offered at the casino is training of all new hires, often from top casino executives or partnered with local nonprofits. Our tribal casino GMs and our TGA directors meet quarterly to discuss best practices and program services. We also display the responsible gaming helpline that's promoted throughout our properties on things like our ATM machines, bathrooms, and more, also on our video lottery terminals. The property also works with vendors to install things for budget limits, time limits, provide scrolling and pop-up messages. Once a person enters our self-exclusion programs, referrals and resources are given to support their journey to health. You may have seen WIGA's Problem Gambling Campaign. It's a digital media strategy to get resources to those who are seeking help and support. This is the second year of the campaign, and the purpose of the campaign is to match those who have a problem and those who are seeking help with problem gambling resources. Our month-long campaign this year served 3.7 million impressions and reached 500,000 via print. The ads we used are visually compelling to get people's attention and encourage them to our website, wildtribescare.org. Here are some examples of placement from our 2021 campaign. The creative approach is a little different this year, but the strategy is the same. The digital media placements include banner ads on news websites and sites related to gambling, addiction, and recovery. We also placed Facebook ads and used Google search optimization. Here's a screenshot from the campaign website, Wild Tribes Care. Please visit it. You'll see the message here that you aren't alone and help is available. And we point to important resources. To date, the website has had over 90,000 visitors. In closing, I think it's important to know that tribes care deeply about this issue and are and are investing resources towards responsible gaming. We appreciate the partnership of others, those here on the call, but also the many agencies, experts, nonprofits, community groups, and passionate individuals who work to address this difficult issue each and every day. I think it's fair to say that important progress has been made, but we all understand this is an ongoing effort. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. I apologize, I was a little thrown off because when I went into presenter mode, I was a screen behind. So thank you.
Well, I think you did great and conveyed a lot of information. So I wanted to kind of hear again something because it had to do with something that Roxanne Waldron said about it's cheaper if we catch the problems early. And so early detection and treatment is important. And of course, the detection piece is the start of that. Mm-hmm. And I thought I heard you say that you do some gambling risk assessment at two different touch points. One was in the court systems. And what was the other?
The other is our behavioral health services.
Okay.
So our health clinics, people seeking treatment for things that may not seem, you know, co-occurring disorders. They may be seeking treatment for alcohol addiction. They're also screened. We have screening as integrated into several of our behavioral health programs.
Okay, thank you. Well, that is great because of, as you said, the highly likely co-occurring disorder situation. And if I can ask Roxanne Waldron, are you still on the line from the HCA?
Yes, I am here. Yes.
Yes. So I know that this was an issue that you touched on in your presentation. You could kind of remind me about screening in court systems, screening in behavioral health services. Is that something that we're currently doing widespread, or is that something that is one of the recommendations perhaps that we should be doing more?
So under the Commissioner Patterson did a wonderful job of presenting the high level recommendations. Under each of the recommendations are a number of strategies, which of course time did not allow us to share. Under there is a strategy that talks specifically about working with behavioral health agencies that are funded with state funding or public funding to make sure, as Rebecca mentioned, within tribal behavioral health, that our state funded agencies or behavioral health services are also at least considering if they will screen for problem gambling. There's no requirement that they do that now. I know that in Oregon, they had initiated that and then had to pull it back. It was initiated legislatively. And then I believe that they got a lot of pushback as having that as a requirement. So as the problem gambling program manager, I envisioned that as being a voluntary effort that our program could help move forward with possibly grants that would enable or behavioral health organizations to at least, you know, implement that and see how that works for them and give them technical support. So that's the question around that. In terms of the court piece, I think that I will leave that for Maureen Greeley to respond to because she is much more knowledgeable about that than I.
Okay, great. Thank you. Great teamwork. Let's see. I am looking to see if I see hands amongst my other colleagues, and I'm not at this very moment. So we will go ahead and transition to our next speaker. Thank you very much, Roxanne. I'm looking at the wrong screen. Rebecca, thank you very much. We appreciate that information and appreciate the work that the tribes are doing. So next up, we have Maureen Greeley, who is, she's with the Evergreen Problem Gambling and my other screen that has my agenda with all my details on it just disappeared. There it is. Executive Director of the Evergreen Council on Problem Gambling. Oh, look at you trying to help me out there. thank you so much. We're seeing your presentation slides. And so please go ahead and start.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. For the record, Maureen Greeley, Evergreen Council on Problem Gambling, Executive Director. Thank you, Chair Kloba, committee members, and guests. I'm very pleased to be a part of this important panel today. So we'll get right into it. And I hope that I can answer some of the questions that have come from members of the committee as we go through this and at the end. Similar to WICA, the Evergreen Council on Problem Gambling is also a 501c3 nonprofit organization. When I came to the organization, we were called the Washington State Council on Problem Gambling, and everyone thought we were a state agency. So thus, part of the reason for changing our name to the Evergreen Council, it also has allowed us to use our mission of ensuring that there are services and programs and prevention and awareness as a public health issue. Gambling disorder is truly a public health issue, and that is one of the things we advocate for at all levels, not only in Washington, but across the country. We do that in partnership with many organizations. Our mission has really grown over the years to be very holistic and integrated so that we do work throughout the continuum of care, whether that is prevention and intervention, awareness and outreach, to treatment and recovery support. We did originate in Washington State, the State Problem Gambling Helpline, which still exists today. It is available 24/7, staffed by real live human beings with language services available and available through phone, text, and chat. So that has been a very important service, and I'll tell you a little bit more about some of the changes that are happening there as well. We also work to support research, and we are one of the foremost leaders in responsible gambling and gaming training, and we have had very wonderful partnerships here in the state, particularly with tribal casinos and with the commercial card rooms and the lottery. The Evergreen Council on Problem Gambling is the Washington State affiliate of the National Council on Problem Gambling, so we have a voice in both Washingtons. And we take that very seriously. In fact, our council has the longest running representation on the National Council on Problem Gambling board and committees. So I currently sit on the executive committee of that board, just rotated off as president, and I will continue to serve in that capacity. So I look forward to that. Some of the things we dealt with in this past year that really impact Washington as well include a review of the National Helpline services. It's very important to know that there is a national helpline, and it is accessible also in every state, even states that do not have call centers of their own or programs and services or a council, so that anyone across the country can call that number. And in Washington, it is connected to the same call center that our Washington number is connected to. So whether you call the Washington number or you call 1-800-GAMBLER, you are going to get referral to services immediately from the same call center. The other things that are happening at NCPG are modernization of the helpline, and that will trickle down to Washington as well, because any modernization that we do on a national level, we will mirror that at our state program. And that is a major focus of 2023. You probably have heard of Problem Gambling Awareness Month or participated in it. If you have not, it is in March every year. And our governor for years has created a proclamation that it marches also Problem Gambling Awareness Month in Washington State. We do a number of things for awareness and prevalence or prevention in our state during that month. In 2023, we have chosen to focus very much on active duty military veterans and their families, because of course in our state we are a very strong military state and there are great needs for services there. There's been a lot of research on military families, particularly active duty on bases, foreign bases where gambling is prevalent. So that will be one focus. But I would like to touch here on another focus that is perennial. Every year there is what is called gambling screening day on the second Tuesday in March. And across the country, our councils and the National Council work to encourage mental health and substance use, other behavioral health programs to screen for problem gambling. If we can get them to do that for one day, we know that it is so easy to add it that many will continue to do it moving forward. So it's our way to try to break that ice and help people see that adding screening for gambling disorder to your screens that you already do on intake and assessment is an easy thing to do that can translate into greater services, because we know that co-occurring disorders are the norm. They are not the exception. Our other advocacy and awareness, and these are all just highlights, we have worked very hard. We have a strong social justice commitment at our council. We have a number of advisory committees because we believe when prevention and outreach and awareness and programs and services are created, they should be created with the guidance and the support of the communities that we serve. The program should be by and for those communities, not just about those communities. That means translation. And when I say translation, not just language, but understanding the communities, the cultures, the colors, the images, what is respectful, what is not. So we work very closely and carefully with all of these groups and when we develop our advocacy and awareness programs. A few of those that you can see here. Kaleidoscope is a live streaming program, digital program that we have added that is specifically on topics of mental health equity in communities. And so we have had programs with Black community, LGBTQIA community, Latino, Hispanic, Native American. We hope to have ADA in the future. So these will continue to be broader areas. We also have other digital programs that touch on retirement and health or family. Family recovery is crucial. When we talk gambling disorder, we often think of individuals, but really it the impact on families and communities that extends far beyond just the impact on the individual. We need broader, more comprehensive services for families in our state. We work closely with the Washington State Healthcare Authority, and we were very pleased to participate in the Problem Gambling Task Force. We had three representatives from our council participate among those 28 members on the task force, and we were involved in each and every one of the task force work group participation. So we were pleased to do that, and perhaps even more pleased to be able to support bringing in Gemini Research and Dr. Rachel Volberg, who is one of the leading experts on problem gambling prevalence research, to support the prevalence study from methodology all through to the final report. So we were very pleased to be a part of that process. As we all know, Washington sports betting is here. It is very specific and unique mode, as it is only offered through tribal casinos in brick and mortar casinos at this time. And so we have started a responsible gaming awareness campaign here. The radio and digital elements and microsites are out. We hope to have the television launched by the end of the year, and that will run for 6 months. So this is the first part, and we are trying to encourage sports teams and tribal casinos throughout the state to participate in this program and support it. In prevention, we do prevention in a number of areas, but I wanted to highlight just a couple because they are so important, again, with the partnerships we have. We are working on a very specific Native American youth prevention program. There are some strong Western evidence-based prevention programs for youth around gambling, gaming, and healthy choices. We asked 13 different representatives from different tribal nations in Washington to review those programs with us. And while they were very helpful, they said, these do not work in our communities. This is not what we need for our own youth. We need to incorporate our traditional storytelling, our music, and our art in our programs for prevention. So we are working on that now with an amazing group of people from predominantly Washington, but also Canada, and from tribes across the country who are helping us develop that program. We're also working with the National Latino Behavioral Health Association, the ATTC and PTTC, which are both associations that work on prevention and treatment and awareness in Latinx communities, to work on some very strong programs that we hope to loop the Farm Workers Clinic in Eastern Washington into providing services. First, getting the information out in the right language and the right channels and the right messages, and then making sure that there are treatment providers who speak these languages and understand the cultures to be able to provide the services. Because if we build it and they come and the services aren't there, then what's the point? So I think that Roxanne said very succinctly that we need more treatment providers in Washington around gambling disorder. We also need more treatment providers from different cultures who can fill in gaps and help provide services, particularly when people are, there are great barriers, not only language barriers, but fear of coming forward and seeking treatment is a real barrier in many communities. So we hope to continue these collaborations to work on those programs. In Washington State, we have a Washington State Gambling Counselor Certification Committee that oversees the Washington State Certification of Gambling Counselors. This is a rigorous program of training and continuing education and ethical studies that people go through to receive their certification as a gambling counselor. So we work on that. Roxanne is also a member of that committee. I currently co-chair that committee. And as she said, we are able to provide residential treatment for those who need it, who are referred by a certified gambling counselor in Washington State. That is funded through ECPG, and it is funded in great part through the funds we receive from tribal nations, tribal gaming. So we are able to do that, but we are not currently able to send anyone to treatment in Washington State. And that is something that we kind of ebbed and flowed. We had a facility and then we didn't. And this is, again, a function of maintaining certified counselors at locations and having beds for this. We are probably best known, if any of you have ever had the opportunity to come to our Four Directions or our Focus on the Future conferences. I know that Representative Kloba has, I know that Julia Patterson has. We offer both in-person, again, this year, we return to in-person as well as virtual online, and that may be live webinars. It may also be self-directed continuing education in our field, and that includes education around gaming and gambling disorders, but also co-occurring disorders, also case management, also recovery. We do a lot of peer and recovery coach. So we have become so well known that the International Gambling Counselor Certification Board, which also offers a certification for gambling counselors, has requested us to develop 30-hour certification trainings for faith-based clergy ministry, because as you might imagine, many community groups will be much more comfortable going first to their priest or their congregation for support before they will seek mental health services at a health provider. So we'll be working on that. We already have an exam prep e-course because every counselor who goes for their certification must sit for an exam. And so we created that on behalf of first ourselves in Washington and now for IGCCB. And they also have asked us, because of the great need for people with lived experience to support people with gambling disorder and gaming disorder, to create a 30-hour certification course for peer and recovery coaches. So these are coming up in 2023. We're working on them now, and we're very pleased to be a part of that. As Julia mentioned, the gaming disorder side is something that has not received as much attention as it should, particularly as this is a burgeoning issue all over the world, but certainly as we look at it in Washington and across the country. So with our partners at the Massachusetts Council on Gaming Health, we developed a 15-hour introductory course on gaming disorder. And now we have completed a 30-hour full certification course for those seeking to be certified as gaming counselors. We also have our what we call our core or basic trainings, both for counselors as well as for those who we hope can go on to teach counselors. We need more professionals who are trained to teach counselors as well. So these are some of the programs that we've been working on. One that Rebecca mentioned is responsible gaming. And this is one I'm very proud of. Our Responsible Gaming Staff Training and Resources, our RG STAR program, is a full certification program for gaming partners who would like to complete training of their employees, both supervisors and frontline, who do have a voluntary self-exclusion program, who have policies and procedures for their own employees, such as EAP programs and HR programs to support them. These trainings are available. I'm very excited to tell you that two tribal casinos in Washington have completed the full certification, and that is Angel of the Winds from Stillaguamish and Elane from Cowlitz. We have six other tribal casinos in Washington State who are working toward that right now. And we have also trained the 19 card rooms that are part of the Maverick Gaming commercial program as well. These may be initiated by the casinos, by the TGAs, or the tribal gaming commissions themselves. And so we do training for all of those partners. So happy to share more about that, or you have a QR code there. You can learn much more if you just use that later. Excuse me. I wanted to bring a couple of other challenges and opportunities to close with today. I think that I would agree that in Washington, we already know that there is a challenge to have more certified gambling counselors in our state and to integrate our prevention and treatment and awareness and recovery programs throughout mental health services. That's a given. We talked a little bit about therapeutic justice, and we did have a therapeutic justice program for gambling in Pierce County Superior Court Drug and Family Courts. It was very successful. It ended because we couldn't keep enough certified gambling counselors to treat the people in the court. But what we found and what made it so popular initially with the judges and the prosecuting attorneys and the defense attorneys was that by doing the screening and assessment, they found that more than 20% of the people in drug and family court also had problems with gambling. And that made it very clear that we needed to move forward. There is currently no standalone gambling court that is running. There was one in Amherst, New York, but unfortunately Judge Farrell passed away and it didn't continue on. There is one in Nevada, but Judge Moss has retired and they are still trying to make sure that another judge picks up the baton and goes with it. So there are different models that could be used. We highly recommend having a track that is incorporated into drug and family courts because there are some big incentives, particularly in family court. If a person is looking at possibly losing their children, they have a very big incentive to continue the successful culmination of their work in drug and family court programs. And that's where we found the greatest success with the gambling court as well. So happy to talk more about that and be a part of that in the future. Something that's coming up immediately, if not sooner, I was requested to be on an advisory group for the National Council of Legislators from Gaming States, lovingly known as NCLGS, that Representative Kloba is well aware of as well. And she has been asked to participate in this. They are currently working on a draft on safer and responsible gambling standards and policies that could be rolled out across the country. That said, much of what I shared in my conversations with them is that Washington is unique, that you cannot have a one-size-fits-all when it comes to gambling regulation, particularly when you need to be well-versed, understanding, and respectful of tribal sovereign nations and their right and ability to govern themselves. So I have asked that that be brought in, and that they bring in some tribal guidance as well to that system. And then, of course, very excited that Representative Clova will be there to represent Washington as well. You can see there that this includes advertising guidelines, regulations, responsible gaming for operators and gaming manufacturers as well, and that therapeutic justice recommendation. And last but not least, Representative Wiley brought this up, cryptocurrency and investing and cryptocurrency and gambling, both very big and very burgeoning issues right now. I am happy to tell you that there is a graduate student at the University of Washington, that this is the very topic that he is looking at. And he is our first grant awardee for a dissertation award. And he is doing research to collect primary data on the concepts of speculative trading, cryptocurrency, and how that is impacting young people at the college level. So we're looking forward to watching his progress as he moves through that. I also included in your materials some very timely articles from the New York Times on sports betting changes and challenges. Again, they may not yet impact us here in Washington, but I think the writing is on the wall and really want to kind of be the canary to make sure that we are looking at some of the issues that are impacting other states with regard to sports betting and particularly partnerships with universities, which are very troubling to me. So sorry I lost my voice there at the end, but I am happy to take any questions and wish I could share even more with you.
Well, thank you very much. I know you packed a lot into a small amount of time. And let's see, so because you provided us some information in our packet materials, I'm assuming that we have ways to reach out to you if we have any other questions that occur to us later. I don't see any questions from my colleagues right now. Oh, thank you. Some very good contact information. Excellent. Yeah, I'm very glad to hear that you are part of the group that are considering these responsible gaming guidelines that the Nicolgees is coming up with. And so they're they have a meeting, the winter meeting is the 8th through the 11th. And so I'm going to go to that and chairing or facilitating a panel that will include our own Rebecca George. So
wonderful. Really excited
to hear about that. We'll be discussing Indian gaming. So, all right. Well, thank you so much. That concludes the section of our work session where we are diving deep into problem gambling. And next, we're going to transition to our update from the Social Equity in Cannabis Task Force. And we've got about 15 minutes, but maybe a little bit of cushion to go a little further than that. I'd like to call up our one of the co-chairs of the Social Equity and Cannabis Task Force, Jim Macoso, who is also director of Lucid Lab Group. And another member of the task force is Micah Sherman, and he is in his day job is the co-owner of Raven, and then Anjanae Slaughter, who is the project manager for the Social Equity and Cannabis Task Force, and she is from the Washington State Board of Health. And so really excited to have the three of you here, and again, want to reiterate my thanks on behalf of the whole committee for the work that you have been doing over this several years, and so excited to hear your presentation today, and I'm going to let whoever among the three of you start. So go
ahead. Thank you, Chair Clova. Can everyone see my screen?
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you, Chair Clova, committee members and staff for giving us an opportunity to present on the work of the Social Equity and Cannabis Task Force. As Chair Clova said, I'm Jim Mikoso. I am the community co-chair of the task force in conjunction with my legislative co-chair, Senator Rebecca Saldana. I'm also an owner and operator of a cannabis processor here in Washington and a cannabis research license holder here in Washington as well. Appreciate the opportunity. Today, actually, Micah, why don't you introduce yourself as well before we dive in?
Thanks, Jim. I'm Micah Sherman. I'm also a cannabis licensee in the Olympia area and one of the members of the task force and was the co-lead for a couple of our work groups that Jim will be telling you about here shortly.
Thanks, Micah. And so today, this is just a brief overview of what we're going to go over today, our task force structure, real briefly before we get into the meat of our final recommendations. And then we'll go over some next steps and try to leave a little bit of time for any questions that may come up. So this is an outline of our membership. And just so you're aware, really the task force was created by the legislator back in 2020. And it's authorized by RCW 6950-336. You'll find a little bit more details on that in the materials that were provided to you. But really the goal was to address social equity considerations in the cannabis industry in a comprehensive manner. And really with a legislative mandate to make, a statutory requirement to make recommendations on 8 specific policy topics. As you can see from our membership here, the task force is made up of a diverse group of legislators, agency representatives, community representatives, and business owners. You can also find this list on the health equity website, which is under the Health Disparities Interagency Council under the governor's office. So we appreciate all our members, former and current, for contributing their time and their effort and their energy. As you may or may not know, some of these topics can be quite contentious, especially what's going on in our world right now around social equity topics. In addition to this, our requirement is to deliver our final report of recommendations to the legislator, the governor's office, and the respective agencies by mid-December. So you folks will have an opportunity to really look over the full report in addition to some of the items that we're going to cover here today. This gives you a little idea of kind of our recommendation process. And really the whole goal of making these recommendations is to really think about social equity and the impacts that the war on drugs has had on Black and Brown communities, and to come up with recommendations to provide to legislators like yourself, to the governor's office, and also to agency folks that can kind of address those harms that have been caused, and at least in the context of the cannabis industry, provide some options, some solutions on how to address these harms in a more comprehensive way. And so this was our process to go about doing that. We divided into work groups around our 8 policy topics. In those work groups, we included task force members as well as members of the community, where we addressed our policy topic and then try to come up with a recommendation that addressed those topics and provided some solution. Again, some of this material you'll be able to see again in our full report. But really, the whole goal was to take a community-based approach by allowing people with different viewpoints to really opine on our policy topic. And some of the recommendations that we made certainly had views from, even dissenting opinions. And certainly for us, taking into account even people that maybe didn't agree with some of the, some of the topics that we were trying to address was important in helping us really get a full rounded viewpoint on addressing these topics and then coming up with recommendations. So the image on this slide shows how these proposals were formulated and presented by the task force members to the full task force table for discussion and possible adoption. It's probably important to mention that not every recommendation, in fact, most recommendations did not receive unanimous support from our membership. And so our recommendations are really a consensus of support from our task force members. And so this slide is really, can give you a little bit of background on how we define social equity in order to do our work. I won't read the slide in detail, but, I'll give you kind of the high points. And really that's about developing, strengthening, and supporting policies that prioritize the distribution of resources to Black and Brown communities that have been historically marginalized. And really, we looked at this marginalization in the context of Washington State, specifically by the impacts of policing and cannabis, as well as other war on drug policies, specifically targeting communities. And we showed, and you'll be able to see this in our report, how the communities that were impacted the most tended to be Black and Brown communities. We show some data from Washington State to support that. Social equity in cannabis is now then trying to be intentional about including these communities that were harmed disproportionately into the cannabis industry in a way that creates social and economic justice. And that's how we defined it. And that's kind of what, what was the framework around our work. We're going to go into our recommendations, but before we do, and Mike is going to go over those recommendations in broad strokes, I wanted to share with you kind of our four pillars that we kind of use to unify us in kind of coming up with the recommendations. And that is access, industry support, opportunity, and community investment. Building a just cannabis economy requires addressing these areas in a comprehensive manner. And so we tried to do that across our recommendations. Micah?
Thanks, Jim. So the scope of the task force involved both ongoing work that the Liquor Control Board was doing as part of the legislation that created the task force. So there's a couple of recommendations that are related to that work, and then there's more recommendations that are targeted towards legislative action that were requested as a part of creating the task force. So right now, the two recommendations here are to the LCB about their ongoing rule process. The task force created a scoring rubric that would qualify and prioritize equity applicants with the expectation that there will be a lot more people than there are available license for, and that there needs to be a way to prioritize those folks based on the principles of social equity. So there's a fairly complicated scoring rubric that would be used as a part of that application. And then the rubric that the task force recommended is slightly different from what the LCB is moving forward with in their recently done rules. And this is also, I believe, addressed in their agency request legislation that you'll be seeing this session as well. And then the other one relates to criminal history restrictions related to licensure, which the LCB has already taken action on in a previous rule set very shortly after the bills were passed. So that has been done. Next slide, please. So now we're into the recommendations for the legislature. And again, these were mostly based on requests in the bill about specific topics that we're interested in getting feedback from the task force on. So the first one focuses on policies to expand licensure within the existing licenses, as well as creating new license types, and that both the additional existing license types and new license types should be reserved for social equity applicants for a period of time to allow those equity businesses to establish themselves prior to releasing more of those licenses to the general licensure. The next one is about ensuring that licenses can be located anywhere in the state. Right now, the retail licenses are specific to county in law, And it would be very helpful to both the issuance and the success of these equity retail licenses that they be able to be cited anywhere in the state upon their issuance. That'll make it a lot more flexible and beneficial to those potential licensees to have that flexibility. The next one is that new license types should initially be reissued within the social equity program. And I addressed that in the first one. This is just about making sure that significant amounts of time are available for these businesses to establish themselves. There's a tremendous benefit to being sort of first to market, as they say, and allowing a period of time for that to happen in this program with new license types would be beneficial to the licensees and the program. Next slide. And so the other thing, one of the pillars that Jim mentioned is, support for licensees. So a number of these recommendations are around that. So we create access to these licenses, and then we specifically support those licenses' success through technical assistance and mentorship. So there's some recommendations about expanding the scope of that. There was some technical assistance and grant money in the initial bills. And we did make some recommendations around how to expand and improve those programs, both with professional development and workforce training. That was a request to weigh in on, and the task force did support creating such a program, as well as not just limiting the attempts of social equity to be limited just to the cannabis industry. And so the third bullet point there is about a community reinvestment fund that would take cannabis excise tax revenue or any tax revenue and use that to invest in communities that were harmed by this war on drugs construct, which we know was targeted towards poor Black and brown communities. And so taking money from the tax revenue and putting it into remedying those harms is recommended in the report. The last couple were, again, requests within the bill for the task force to weigh in on. The first one was about how do we involve the Department of Agriculture in the regulation of cannabis and what sort of impacts would that have on equity and the equity program. We did recommend that be explored and that there are potential benefits to involving the Department of Ag in the regulation of cannabis on equity. The Department of Ag has taken significant steps as a result of the HEAL Act to incorporate equity proposals into all their policymaking, and they do have an apparatus starting and developed to do that. And there's definitely benefits, both specifically to equity, social equity, but there's also benefits to the general equity of the cannabis industry, which will support social equity implicitly. So there are advantages to considering that, and we do recommend that be looked at. And then the last one was about home grow. So would there be an equity component to allowing home grow? And there was a great work group on that topic, and we got some information from a number of people, including a lot of data-driven information from somebody you guys are familiar with, John Kingsbury, who's worked on this topic. And he discovered through quite a bit of records requests with the sheriff's office that there is a disproportionate effect on plant arrests in Washington state that is tied to race. So we're seeing much higher numbers of Black people arrested for small number of plants at home, whereas the arrests of other races are often much larger, more commercial scale grows. So we did find that allowing a small number of homegrown plants would have a positive benefit in that regard, where it would reduce the number of racially disproportionate arrests for that activity. So we do recommend as a part of the report that some amount of home grow be implemented, and that it would be beneficial to the goals of social equity. And so that is the summary of all of our recommendations. And obviously there's lots of complicated nuance and detail to all of these. And this is a very high level overview. And then Jim will close us out.
The committee was provided with materials that give you the detailed actual recommendations that were approved by the task force. And of course, the full report is being provided to the legislator, the governor's office, as well as the relevant agencies in the next couple of weeks by mid-December. Our last meeting as a task force, our last official meeting as a task force is next week on December 7th. That's open to the public. Anybody can attend. That's a two-hour meeting. And in that meeting, we're going to kind of finalize our report, approve it more or less as a task force. And once it's approved, then the final touches will get made and it'll get packaged appropriately to be sent to the relevant parties. But, you know, this is really, as a task force, this is where our, you know, official work ends. We've been extended by the legislator through the end of the fiscal year, so the middle of next year. But more or less, this is really just where the work begins. We've, as a task force, we're making these recommendations, but the whole goal of our task force is to bring this conversation to light, to put it in front of the appropriate parties that can actually move on this and actually bring this into relevant policies that can be impacted at our state level. You know, to get people to recognize harms that were caused to specific communities and to act on it are two different things. Recognizing there's a problem and doing something about it are never the same. You guys are legislators, so I'm sure you're aware of the amount of effort it takes to take a good idea and actually turn it into actionable items. But, you know, for us, the next, you know, our official work is ending. And I will say that it was real work. It involved a lot of spirited conversation. I know I've spoke to a couple of folks that are even in here that are part of our membership team, and even you, Chair Clova, about my experience in being a part of this process of having difficult conversations and trying to find consensus amongst people that maybe don't agree. I am not a politician. I'm a business owner and I'm the boss. If people don't agree with me, I'll listen. But oftentimes, as the boss, I have to make decisions despite people's input, and maybe sometimes in spite of people's input. But in this work, you know, one of the most important things that I've learned and that I would, relay to you folks at the legislature is, you know, this is a very important time in our history as a country, and certainly here at the state level on this topic. You know, other states, and you know, I'm active in other states as well. Other states are watching the work that we do around this topic, how we address social equity, how we address harms that were caused by, you know, kind of antiquated, some would say even racist policies at the federal level that have impacted specific communities over time. And what we are going to do as a state to address it actively, specifically in the context of cannabis and the cannabis industry and social equity policy. So, you know, the next steps for us involve officially creating this report and distributing it to the appropriate parties. But the real work is what happens beyond here in these conversations. So we really appreciate you guys having us in here to kind of share with you at a high level what we've been working on. Obviously, you're going to see a report that isn't a few slides, that's very comprehensive, and I would encourage you to read it. Certainly, we're available. We're available to be contacted if you have some questions about the report or you'd like to, you know, maybe get some of our take on it beyond this. But we really look forward to seeing what you folks here in this committee, as well as other legislators in the state, do from here. Thank you very much. We're happy to take any questions that you may have at the time we have left.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And I do definitely recognize That having difficult conversations is a whole entire skill set that it takes some time and effort to develop that. So I appreciate the work that you did and the work of the rest of the group, and hopefully that those are tools that'll continue to serve you well in future conversations and activities that you might take on. Let's see, I don't see any hands up. So I did write down one question for myself, and it was just clarifying. I know one of the recommendations was creating new license types reserved for social equity applicants. And I wanted to understand, is that the license types we have now, research, producer, processor, those type of things that are reserved for social equity candidates, or are you thinking of some new license types, new activities we don't allow, like right now, like a consumption lounge or delivery or things like that? Can you help me help clarify what you mean by new license types?
Yeah, so it's the new license types was about new activities that don't currently exist. That was one of the requests of the enabling legislation, was to weigh in both on the creation of new licenses of the existing types, as well as new types of licenses. So what we did end up talking about were, as you said, social consumption and delivery. And we did make some detailed recommendations about both of those and how they could be done with an eye towards equity, both in their like limited distribution to the equity program, as well as ways that they could be structured that would allow for an equitable business ecosystem to be developed within those license types. Because definitely one of the things that we talked about a lot was, if we want these equity licensees to exist in perpetuity and for there to be an equitable economy that continues to exist, then we actually need to structure these business types in a way that small and mid-sized businesses are viable, long-term, ongoing concerns, and not just like a speculative rush to get bought out in a tumultuous moment, but actually building regulatory systems that support long-term equitable outcomes. And the way that delivery and the way that social consumption is executed will inform that a great deal.
Okay, great. Thank you for clearing that up for me. And okay, so I don't see any other questions, but thank you for putting that contact information for the health equity at State Board of Health. And I just want to thank the folks that are sort of invisibly behind the scenes, both Victor Coleman, and I think the magic invisible fingers on Janae Slaughter were helping with the visuals there probably. And all of our OPR staff and tech staff who help us make these meetings go beautifully and smoothly. And thank you all so much. If it's snowing where you are, take care and anywhere you're going. And really, thank you so much for joining us, everyone. I think we, unless there is objection, and I don't see any, we are adjourned. Thank you.